This is Frontierland with Dr. Dean Allen.
Hello, my name is Dean Allen and you are listening to Frontierland. In this series, I'll be introducing you to some of the most inspirational people here in South Africa, each with a unique story to tell. Div de Villiers' authoritative yet engaging personality makes for an enlightening and at times humorous interview. But on listening closer, you will learn of the very serious nature of his work and the challenges he and his colleagues face on a daily basis. It's a message every one of us should listen to. Enjoy. Div, this is an interview I've been waiting for. An absolute pleasure to have you in the studio today and to introduce you to our guests. It probably doesn't work on a podcast, but I've just got to describe you to people. I mean, you're a giant of a man. I mean, you're 6'5". I think you've got size 15 feet. You are known as the big protector in these parts of the world. You are for me an inspiration in terms of what you do for conservation in Eastern Cape. Before we go any further, what does the word conservation mean to you, Div?
Dean, yeah, thanks very much. Thanks for the opportunity to speak and hello to everyone out there. So conservation to me, I think let's look at the 1980s definition, and that's the first thing that I always respond to. It's the wise utilization of our natural resources for the benefit of present generations and future generations. So that's actually the definition. It's the one that I like to use. I think it sort of sums up what conservation is. But to be frank, to me, it's more than that. You know, conservation is about life. Everything that we do revolves around conservation. It's about sustaining the natural world, and we depend on the natural world. So looking after the natural world, I think it's important for all of us to do. And that's really why I got into this profession. I really believe in it.
I love the story how you got into the profession, and you know, it was quite a roundabout way of doing it. Your upbringing, your inspiration in nature, but also at an early age. I mean, you're a teenager. You're actually thrust into military service. You came out of that world, which I'm sure taught you a lot of life lessons, and you found yourself at Rhodes University for only 3 months. Now, you've got a PhD now, and I know you've gone back to Rhodes, and you've obviously completed those studies. But the early days, they weren't so successful in terms of studies, were they?
No, the early days weren't very successful. In fact, even primary school wasn't successful in terms of studies. I was a terrible student. I was a terrible pupil. But that's actually where it started. So in Resedale Primary School in the outskirts of Johannesburg, in the 1960s, there were plots, small holdings, and there was a small school that was established there, Resedale Primary School. It was still prefab classrooms. I think I was the second intake into that school. And I was pretty much Afrikaans-speaking little boy at that stage, and this was an English school. We had a headmistress, a spinster by the name of Jane Fraser. And this little old lady with her purple hairdo was way ahead of her time. She taught us all about conservation, and every Friday we'd have, you know, movies about conservation on those old projectors. We'd have walks to the local dam at Darrenwood. And she'd teach us about birds, teach us about pollution. So, I mean, you're talking about the 1960s. It was way before, you know, most people were talking about conservation and environmental stuff. So I think the seed was sown already at that age. And you know, teachers and headmistresses and so forth, obviously a key part of raising anyone. Children look up to them. You know, that's who you listen to even more than your parents. But then, as you say, eventually went to the army, and that's our conscription. We had to go for 2 years in 1981. I went into the army deciding that rather than just going through 2 years, I'll do the best I can. I'll do everything that I can, everything that's available to me, because I'm quite an adventurous sort of guy. So anything that was available, parachuting, demolitions, mine lifting, you know, I did the officer's course. I became an officer. And then I was moved to I applied for the 31 Battalion, which was a Bushman Battalion. And there again, that was a life-changing experience. I spent a year with the Bushmen. I was a company commander there. And, oh, I mean, what amazing little people. Now, for listeners out there that don't understand the apartheid years, I was at an all-white school. All white kids went to all white schools. I didn't have contact with black people until the army. That was when I lived with them, operated in the bush with them, and the first time that actually I realized, you know, these guys are the same as what I am. They're great people, and I built up such a good relationship with the bushmen. And of course, everyone knows bushmen are just like the ultimate conservators. They were the hunter gatherers in South Africa, so that was a life-changing experience that year up there. And when I was finished in the Caprivi and Angola and so forth, I knew I'm not going back to Johannesburg. I've got to do a career in conservation. I went to Rhodes University. So Rhodes, being one of the universities that offered a Bachelor of Science, I looked at it. It was far away from where far away from Johannesburg, first of all, and far away from my parents. You want to get away from your parents. You don't want to come back from the army. And then the other thing that the main sort of attraction was that they advertised that they had six girls to one guy. So, so that was the final pulling point, and off to Rhodes I went. Unfortunately, I didn't last long there, Dean. I was there for 3 months, as you say, just partying too much, just playing rugby, and I won't go into the great details, but I was eventually asked to leave Rhodes University after just 3 months.
Well, don't they call that the University of Life? I mean, that's part of education, isn't it?
It certainly taught me a few things, but the fortunate thing that was, while there was a sort of internal inquiry into my conduct and all the rest, my hooker from the rugby team came in with a newspaper in his hand, and he carried a dispatch in. He said, hey, Tiff, you want to be in conservation? Look at this, there are 11 posts available here in Grahamstown, right there in Grahamstown, which is now called Makanda. And I grabbed that newspaper and I ran through to the offices of the Nature Conservation. I didn't even know there was a regional office for Nature Conservation in Grahamstown. And it was actually the office for the entire Eastern Cape. And I had a torn T-shirt. It was messed up with an acid explosion that I'd been messing around in the science class with. I still had acid burns. I remember I couldn't play rugby for Rhodes because of the acid burns on my arm and down my back and that. But when I arrived at this office, they said, no, they're urgently looking for people to do law enforcement. And the woman at the reception, the switchboard, said, go up and Mr. Edwards is going to interview you. I said, I can't go like this. Look at me. And she said, no, Bedford Edwards is fine. He'll interview you. And she commented a bit on how big I was and all the rest, and I'd be a good law enforcement officer. And to cut a long story short, I got the job. You know, he gave me a very interesting interview, which I've recorded in one of my books, but I won't put that out there. It was certainly different to the way that we interview people today.
It's amazing how your life took that turn. And as I said, 3 months at Rhodes, it led to opportunities clearly in another way. You're part of what's famously known as the Green Scorpions. Can you give me an idea of how that name came about and the role that they play in conservation?
Yeah, so obviously my career has been very varied, all sorts of conservation that I've been involved in. But I was working in the Maluti-Drakensberg areas of South Africa, and the town known as Kokstad, that's where I was based, working the Wild Coast, working the Drakensberg Mountains and so forth. But I got to a point in my career where I wanted to progress beyond an assistant manager, and my kids also needed some high schooling, so they would have had to go to other schools if I stayed on in Kokstad. And a position was advertised in the Bishu head office for the Eastern Cape, and that was to establish a law enforcement unit for the province. This was now in 2007. I decided, after chatting with my wife and my kids, I decided I was going to go for this. See, you know, because I've done law enforcement. At that stage, I wasn't only doing law enforcement, I was doing all sorts of other things as well, establishing reserves and really nice stuff. And I got the job. I went for the interview, and surprisingly, I got the job, because when I go for an interview, I'm completely open. I will talk about my past. I'll talk about the years in the military, et cetera, et cetera. There's no use trying to hide things. And the fact of the matter, with affirmative action at that stage and so forth, I really didn't think I was going to get the job, but I was given the job and ended up as the Director of Compliance and Enforcement. And we had new legislation recently promulgated, national legislation, not only our provincial laws. And this required us to go for special training to become environmental management inspectors, EMIs as they are known. That in effect allows us to do enforcement of the National Environmental Management Act and various other specific environmental management acts like the Biodiversity Act, Water Act, Air Quality Act, and so forth. And it's quite comprehensive training. But the title that you eventually get after that is an environmental management inspector of different levels. So, you know, I was appointed as a grade one or level one EMI, and that allows me to do a whole lot of different things in terms of basically the whole suite of things in terms of that legislation, law enforcement, signing of letters, signing of directives, and so forth. But when Martinus van Schalkwyk, who was the environmental minister at the time, was asked about this unit that was now being established across the country, not only at national level but also in provincial levels, he started talking about the Department of Economic Development, Environmental Affairs and Tourism, Environmental Management Inspectors. And of course, this didn't sound sexy at all. It just didn't have a catchphrase to it. And van Schalkwyk, apparently, this is how the story goes, he thought about the Scorpions at the time, the National Prosecuting Authority and the police, the specialists, the what is now the known as the Hawks, or that are the specialist unit that we have in the police. And instead of calling us the Environmental Management Inspectorate, he decided to call us the Green Scorpions. So he told the media that these guys are the Green Scorpions, and that's how the name came about, and that's how the name has stuck. So we are now known as the Green Scorpions.
Wow, which is an effective name as well. It's a lot easier to write and it's a lot easier to remember than that title that you had before. Listen, in your books, because you've written some wonderful books about your experiences over the years, but I read that you describe the real heroes of the wildlife wars as the investigators and rangers who work the long hours to solve the crimes and arrest the criminals. Do you think these people get the support they require?
No, they're never going to get the support that they require. And I really mean those words about them being the real heroes. You know, I was there at one stage. For the last number of years, I haven't been there. I've been in the managerial corridors and those ivory towers and trying to make it easy for those people that are the real heroes to actually do their work. So whereas I do still get in the field as much as I possibly can, those guys that are tirelessly working on the ground are the ones that deserve all the accolades. And budgets are poor, conditions are poor. You know, if they work in a good team, then certainly they get some support, but they certainly don't get the financial support for it. They don't get sufficient time off for the hard work that they put in. But I must say, you know, those are the days that I miss, because if you really believe in conservation, then that's where you want to be.
At the coal face, as it were.
You want to be at the coal face. No, that's the place to go to. So, one day I'll get back there.
I mean, one of the most high-profile, of course, causes that we've got, and unfortunately it does affect us here in the Eastern Cape, but certainly it's a Southern African, if not a world problem, is the poaching of certain endangered or certainly prized species. And the rhino, of course, gets a lot of attention in terms of that. Having looked at what you've done in the past, Div, it's not just about rhino, it's about different species, and we'll talk about that going on. But the rhino certainly captures the imagination of the public, and rightly so. You were, I believe, involved in the very first rhino poaching incident here in the Eastern Cape at Shamwari. Can you remember what happened?
Yeah, maybe just a quick little background about rhino, and that, you know, we all know that it's one of these South African success stories, the conservation success stories. We know how Ian Player in particular led, with a team obviously of people, but led the rehabilitation of, or the reintroduction of rhino and the reintroduction of populations in various areas when rhino were on the brink of extinction. So we've all looked up to the guys of that era that accomplished such a monumental feat. Eastern Cape is a province that has quite a lot of rhino. One of the species South Africa's got two species. We've got white rhino and we've got black rhino. Eastern Cape is predominantly black rhino. That's the rhino that has historically occurred here. And we've got we're very proud of our population of black rhino. Now, we never had a poaching incident of all the years since the project of Player in them, and whereas other parts of the country had been experiencing at least some poaching. Now, around about 2005, there was a bit of a spike. You could see the spike in rhino poaching. It hadn't hit the Eastern Cape yet, but we started losing rhino horns. There were thefts of rhino horns. 2005, 2006, 2007, museums were hit, game farms were hit, even armed robberies of some of the museums. People were tied up in the Amatola Museum, for example, the curators and that, and horns were lassoed off the walls. So we realized that this is just a matter of time before the poaching was going to hit the Eastern Cape. And lo and behold, it was December 2008 that I got a call. I was around the Braai fire. It was about 8:30 in the evening. And I got a call from my 2IB, which is I was my second in charge at that stage, Jaap Pienaar. And he said to me, I just remember his words, he said, "The rhino down." And we'd been talking about it for so long, I knew exactly what he was talking about. And asked him where it was. He said, "No, it was Shamwari." Now, Shamwari is one of the prime private game reserves in South Africa. And we decided we couldn't go to Shamwari at that stage because it was evening. It's got lion and dangerous predators and that around as well. It's not possible to go and do a crime scene at that time of the night. So we decided we'd be there the first light the next morning. Shamwari is about a three-hour drive from East London, where I was. So I was up very early, and off I went and met Jaap as the sun was rising at Shamwari. And we went to the poaching scene, and it's difficult to describe the first time that you see such a magnificent beast lying in the veld, and it's peppered with AK-47 wounds. It's lying dead, and it just knocks the wind out of your sails. So what had basically happened there was poachers had shot this rhino with the AK-47, and they weren't very accurate, so they'd sprayed it full of bullets. And there was a game guide that was out that night with tourists, and he'd had a particularly interesting sighting of lions, so he stayed out a bit later than what he was supposed to, and that was not supposed to happen. So the poachers were in the veld thinking no one else was there, and he heard the automatic fire going, you heard the shooting, and he radioed through. And then he actually saw the rhino run past the vehicle as well, with blood coming out of its nostrils and mouth. So the poachers were disturbed, and they never removed the horns. And the rhino ran about 2 kilometers before it finally died. That's what we came across, and that's how we started our investigation. I was working then with the South African Police Services, and that was the beginning of it all in the Eastern Cape. It escalated from there. Eventually, there were syndicates that were operating with using dart guns and M99 tranquilizers, sawing off the horns of rhino while they were still alive so that they bled to death. Horrible stuff, really horrible stuff.
Do you ever get used to that kind of experience? I mean, do you have to desensitize yourself? Because it must be quite a harrowing thing to witness.
I don't think you ever get completely used to it, but you do tend to desensitize yourself. And it's something that we've got to watch against, because especially the investigators that have seen, you know, some investigators have seen hundreds of rhinos that are dead, and it becomes a part of their daily duty. Now, my team, I've always said to them, always remember that the rhino that you're seeing there, the owners of that rhino perhaps have never seen a dead rhino before. It's in many cases, it's almost like their baby that's lying there. So we've always got to be mindful to show respect to the animal, which comes without saying anyway. But really, you know, be respectful of the people that are around there. You don't want everyone around a crime scene, but obviously the owners, and they do see the animal that's lying dead. And yeah, you do desensitize yourself to some degree.
It's all part of understanding how nature works, and how certain species, obviously, because of man, because of this demand for something like a rhino horn that has developed. Is there any way we can control the demand, perhaps? Is it through education, or do we have to stop it at the ground level? I mean, where does this chain need to be broken in terms of the destruction of a potential destruction of a species that's held so dear to us here in Africa? That's for sure.
Yeah, look, law enforcement is only a stopgap measure in this whole rhino war, as a lot of people call it. Ultimately, you know, it's going to be through education and through people deciding not to use rhino horn. So I often get asked the question, you know, am I pro rhino horn trade or am I against it? And it's a very difficult one for me to answer, because there are pros and cons to both ideas. You know, you can potentially flood the market. Some people say you can't flood the market. We don't really know. Are you going to be able to flood the market? Aren't you going to be able to flood the market? You know, lots of species have been successfully traded, and in that way their conservation has been secured. You're thinking species like the Nile crocodile, the ostrich, you know, in our Eastern Cape province, the hunting of the foal roebuck, the grey roebuck. It's a massive conservation success story on the brink of extinction, and then hunters came and looked after it and said, there's a price on this animal. It's got a magnificent straight horn. And suddenly everyone wanted grey roebuck. And now, you know, you've got a decent population of grey roebuck. And so the list can go on and on. But rhino is a different kettle of fish, or a different animal to when you look at it. But it is it's an emotive, for one. It's a flagship species. It's one of our big five. It's questionable should one, you know, put these rhino into paddocks and then harvest their horn, because the horn keeps growing. If you cut it off, it continues to grow. So it can be harvested sustainably, and there are models and ideas to look at it in that way. It makes some sense. But the other thing is the ethical question. But we, you know, science has determined that rhino horn does not actually work in reducing fever. It does not work, as in later years people have said, as an aphrodisiac. It does not work for various things that it is. A hangover cure, that was one of the later ones that came out, and a cancer cure. So why should we then want to trade in something that we know doesn't work? So my take on it, after speaking to a lot of people like Colin Bell and like the Wilderness Foundation of Africa, and we debate these things many a time, I think I'm leaning more towards education, getting the next generations that are going to come to just say, guys, we don't need rhino horn. The rhino horn needs to be on the rhino. You know, I'd like to see at the end of the day, I'd like to see that scenario play out in the next 20 years.
Your role protects not only rhino, but all species endangered. Talk a little bit about a plant species, the cycad, which is probably not so well known, not so high profile, but also has an important part on our ecosystem, and is also very important in here in Eastern Cape, isn't it, in terms of our culture and wildlife?
Yeah, plants aren't, unfortunately, as sexy as big and hairy wildlife like the rhino, so they don't get as much attention. I know I've struggled over the years to even get television programs to follow the work that we do in combating smuggling of cycads, smuggling of succulents, and the clearing of the thicket species. It's a felt type that only sort of occurs here on the Eastern Cape, and it's being destroyed before our eyes. But to get back to the cycads, they are particularly rare plants. The Eastern Cape have a number of species of cycads. They're endangered now. All of them are considered endangered. Some of them have been wiped out of the felt completely, so that you don't get them in the natural environment anymore. And some of them are, you know, they're just basically a handful that's left. And the big market there is for landscaping, and particularly to the Gauteng, Johannesburg market. So over the years, certainly from the 1980s, there's been a lot of trade in that. And they're actually quite valuable plants. So it's lucrative to have people take these plants out of the felt and transport them to Johannesburg or wherever the target market is. Obviously, the people that are digging them out get paid a pittance. And then you get couriers that'll take them up through to Gauteng, and the landscapers or the nurseries or whatever in that market there will then benefit substantially, because sometimes it's a few thousand rand for a couple of centimeters. So, and these plants can get big. You get plants that are 4 or 5 meters tall in some species. So we've concentrated on that organized crime, on those syndicates that have been involved in that. And when we established a special investigation unit in the Eastern Cape in around about 2009, we had tremendous success in bringing down a number of those syndicates. At one stage, we had 42 people in jail, and that's people from across the racial divide. There were black guys, white guys, colored, name it. People were in jail, and that was sending an immensely strong message out that Eastern Cape's not tolerating smuggling of cycads. Now, those prison sentences varied from 7 years to 11 years. So it wasn't a slap on the wrist. And that's where you can see enforcement working, because there was zero absolutely zero cycad poaching while these guys were sitting in jail. Unfortunately, recently there's been an amnesty and a lot of those cycad poachers have been released from jail and they're back at it. They've gone straight back to their old ways because it's what they know, and it's a lucrative industry to be in, and it's quite difficult to catch them, unlike things like cash in transit and some of the other crimes which are more high risk. You know, dealing in plants is something that you can have a pretty good chance of getting away with.
It's probably, I wasn't aware of this trade in cycads, which has opened my eyes up to the fact that we tend to think about rhino poaching and other endangered species, but it's all about protecting our ecosystem, isn't it? It starts from the plants, the flora, the fauna, to go up to the big, as you said, the big five. Just to lighten the mood a little bit, though, one of my favourite stories we shared over dinner last night was a story involving, we've already mentioned, Jaap Pienaar, one Christmas and a cycad. What happened?
Yeah, look, there's some horrible moments in conservation, but I've been at it for 40 years and there's been some great moments as well. So the camaraderie that there's been, the teamwork, all of that, that is just so special. And you meet a lot of characters along the way. So one of the great characters of the Eastern Cape, a very, very good friend of mine, and I mean, we've been colleagues for forever, is Jaap Pienaar. So he's a large fella and really enjoys his entertainment and entertaining people and telling stories and so forth. Anyway, he's extremely committed to conservation as well. And it was one December that he was coming back from Overston, which is a town right up in the Free State border. And he was driving back to PE, as it was known then, where he was living, looking forward to getting back to his wife and kids for some Christmas. And he was going through in his Ford Cortina at the time, racing through the roads of the Eastern Cape and nearing PE in a place called Alexandria, just between Alexandria and PE. And there, on oncoming traffic, he saw a vehicle with a cycad tied onto the roof, being transported and coming in the opposite direction. And he thought to himself, jeez, I've got Christmas waiting for me over here, and now this fool is driving in open daylight, broad daylight, with a cycad, massive cycad tied to his roof, with the leaves all tied down, as these smugglers very often do. They tie the leaves, these spiky leaves of cycads, to their trunk. So, you know, with a little bit of hesitation, he decided, no, you'll chase this guy. And he broadied off the road then, put his blue light on, started flashing his lights and chasing this vehicle with a cycad on the roof. And he reckons he was working his way through the gears and eventually was catching up on this vehicle. And as he got closer, he saw in the back of the vehicle two kids with their eyes, as he said, bigger than pirings, because he's Afrikaans, so pirings are saucers. His eyes bigger than pirings. And as he got closer, he saw that there was a woman in the car as well in the passenger seat, but he flashed the lights and the car pulled over. And he got out and he walked towards the vehicle and he just saw the fear in the people's eyes. And the husband opened the door and got out and started walking towards him. And that's when he looked at the cycad on the roof and he realized it was one of those plastic Christmas trees that had been wrapped up. So the poor guy said to Jaap, you know, what did I do wrong? He said, no, my name is, you done nothing wrong. My name's Jaap Pienaar. I'm from Nature Conservation. I just would like to wish you and your family a Merry Christmas.
No, it's a wonderful story. And as I said, I'm sure humour just must keep you sane in your job, which is, let's face it, it helps us all in this day and age. Just to think about the future, because it is all about, you know, today is all about the future of our planet, etc. What is the future of conservation and security, certainly here in the Eastern Cape, but nationally as well? There's a suggestion perhaps that maybe going private will be part of the direction we take. What do you think? I mean, what are your hopes for the future?
Dean, I think we all know that economically the country's in a bit of a bad way, and we've been hit by a whole lot of massive problems from COVID through to unrest. And the priorities that the government have that they've got to put money into. I would like to say that environment is one of the priorities, but you know, you've got health, you've got the security, the policing, education, all very important fields that the government has to put money into. So let's be realistic, and I don't think we're going to get much money in our budgets for environmental affairs and conservation. The budgets have been cut for the last number of years. They've really been cut to the bone. And I think that the future relies on partnerships with the private sector. So I really believe that you know, businesses and the public and communities are going to have to come to the fore. Non-government organizations, non-profit organizations, philanthropists, people that really believe in conservation and have the ability to put money towards it and to put time towards it and voluntarily assist the government. The government will always play a part, so they have to be there. There's got to be rules, legislation has to be complied with. You know, you can't just have every Tom, Dick and Harry doing whatever they want to. But I think that those partnerships are key if we're going to have conservation, in you know, real meaningful conservation going off into the future. And South Africa has been a leading country in the field of conservation for many years, well over a century. We've been one of the top countries in the world. So we're going to have to think out of the box in this one. And hopefully we can get people together that come up with those sorts of ideas. But it's definitely going to be more and more coming from the private sector.
You've already mentioned organisations like the Wilderness Foundation that have proven they've been there for a long time. We've just celebrated their 50th year, for example. They've proven to have a success rate, longevity. How can people out there who want to do good, who want to give support, how can they do so? Because I'm sure there's been a few unscrupulous bodies out there that in the name of conservation have taken people's money and perhaps not used it in the right way.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, you know, especially I think of when the rhinos first started falling, how many of these non-government organizations and fundraisers suddenly jumped up. At one stage, I remember we had more than 400 fundraising bodies pleading for money and people willingly donating because they just saw the atrocities being committed to these poor creatures. But unfortunately, you know, only two, perhaps three of those organizations actually gave money to us in the Eastern Cape, which just shows how many sharks there can be out there. So I think people that have the financial means to donate to conservation just need to do a little bit of homework, see which organizations have a good track record, who's really providing a service to conservation. And those are the areas that the money should be directed. But it's not only about finance. A lot of people have time. A lot of people have different skills, perhaps, you know, like attorneys, helicopter pilots, et cetera, et cetera. And they volunteer their time. Now, there's a system there's provision in the legislation for honorary nature conservation officers, or to put it in other terms, volunteers. And I think that is one of the key things for the future as well is that we need to just drive that process, get more volunteers established and designated. And it's not a new thing, because when Cape Nature Conservation started in 1952, Dr. Douglas Hay already had honorary nature conservation officers appointed. In fact, there were 500 in the Cape at one stage, and they were very proud that 20 of those were women. So I think at the moment the honorary officers, we depend on them. We depend on them for a lot of assistance in terms of just patrols, compliance monitoring, visibility. The South African National Parks and the Isimvelo KZN Wildlife use them a lot for work in the protected areas. And even the Eastern Cape Parks and Tourism Agency have friends of the Babians Kloof and so forth. So the time and expertise of those volunteers is very important.
Well, Div, I'd just like to finish by saying thank you for your almost 40 years of service. Quite an incredible journey. Do you look back now and with a sense of pride or almost frustration that you've not eradicated these crimes that have given you a job over that time?
Yeah. No, look, it's been a fantastic ride of 40 years. The experiences, the friendship, the team, as I mentioned earlier, just the teamwork, the people that you've met along the way, both within the department and outside, has been absolutely fantastic. I hope it's going to carry on when I leave this department and go into the private sector and go into the future. I certainly don't want to leave conservation. But yeah, it's mixed emotions, because you've certainly accomplished quite a lot. I think the rewards have been like where conservancies and protected areas have been established, and you've been one of the driving forces in getting teams together to actually get that off the ground. That, to me, is some of the great rewards of the past 40 years. The work on the Wild Coast, that magnificent Wild Coast, which I'm so fond of, and the Maluti Drakensberg Transfrontier Project. There are just so many things that have been absolutely fantastic to be a part of. But the law enforcement, it's got to be done. You know, that legislation, that's your Bible. That's what you have to learn from when you start in conservation. You must know, this is my Bible. I must know what's going on here because this drives everything. This is what it's all about. And unfortunately, there are also people that have to enforce that law. And that's not always the most pleasant task. And the people that are enforcing it aren't always looked upon as being the, you know, the favorite people of society. But there's also a way in which you enforce the law. And you've got to do it with the, you know, considering the dignity of the people that even though they may be poachers, even though they may be criminals, you enforce the law in such a way that you still have respect for the people that are being arrested to a degree. You know, I mean, obviously, that's very difficult at times, especially if it's been a horrible crime, and to do something with respect and show dignity. But that's what you actually got to do. But seeing that devastation continuously on almost a daily basis is hard. You know, people that are right there at the coalface of rhino poaching. I think of the guys in the Kruger Park that every day would see at least one dead rhino. It's not the most pleasant experience. It's something that, you know, law enforcement, something that can get you down. And you don't see the, you know, perhaps don't see the bigger picture. You don't see the rewards like someone that's in a reserve doing reserve management. They're not immediately apparent. It's very nice when people come to you sometimes and say, geez, you know, are you so-and-so? Well, thanks so much for all the hard work that you've been doing in putting criminals behind bars, in doing law enforcement, in trying to, you know, keep the Eastern Cape a beautiful province. You know, then there's a little bit of reward and you realize, oh, actually, maybe we've made some difference.
No, you've certainly made a difference, and in the time I've spent in your company, you can see the difference you make to people around you. You're an ambassador for not only wildlife, but for this province, and for that I thank you, and I wish you all the best in the future, but conservation needs you, the world needs you, so please don't go retiring too soon, will you?
No, thanks, Dean, and thanks for all that you're doing as well, and you know, recording everything that's been going on in the province. I think it's so important. You know, it was one of the reasons why I wrote a few books, recording those stories, trying to remember the characters that they've been, and remembering some of the stories of conservation in the Eastern Cape. So you've got a very important task, and I look forward to giving you some assistance in the future.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That was Frontierland with Dr. Dean Allen. For more podcasts, visit algoafm.co.za.
I hope you found this episode both entertaining and inspirational. Please do download, share, and subscribe to the podcast so that we can highlight the positive stories coming out of our nation. South Africa is indeed a special place with special people. You can find out more about me at my website, deanallen.co.za. Please do get in touch. So until next time, please be kind to yourself and others. Goodbye.